We are talking with John Perkins. He is author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John, talk about Saudi Arabia. That's a country that is very prominent in our current political climate, and you had firsthand experience with that country.
That's right, Mike. I think you're probably too young to remember the early 70s when we had cars lined up at gas stations. We had a severe oil shortage in this country, and it was because OPEC had finally exercised its power and decided that it was going to basically hold the United States up to ransom. It didn't like our policy in Israel particularly. And this became totally unacceptable to the United States government. We were afraid that we might have another depression like 1929, that this oil problem could really create that sort of a situation. So the U.S. Treasury Department came to me and a number of other economic hitmen, a very small group of us, and I went to Saudi Arabia and began looking at what the possibilities were. And it became very evident at the beginning that the key to making sure this would never happen again was Saudi Arabia. It was the largest producer in the world, and basically Saudi Arabia could control OPEC. Didn't have to control it politically, but if other countries decided that they were going to cut back on the supply of oil and Saudi filled in the gap, then it didn't do any good for these countries to decide this. So knowing that Saudi would be on our side would deter any foreseeable problems. So we had to win Saudi Arabia over. So we ended up putting together this deal whereby the House of Saud, the Royal House of Saudi Arabia, agreed to reinvest the petrodollars, most of its petrodollars, into U.S. government securities. The U.S. Treasury Department was given the right to use the interest from these government securities to hire U.S. companies to rebuild Saudi Arabia in a westernized image, to literally build cities straight out of the desert, to build big transmission lines, power plants, desalinization plants, petrochemical industries, the whole works, to rebuild Saudi Arabia as a westernized country. And in exchange, we would guarantee that the House of Saud, the royal family, would continue to rule the country as long as they kept their deal with us. Part of their deal with us also assured that the price of oil would stay within limits that would be acceptable to us. This deal has held all these years from the early 70s, really it was finalized about the mid-70s, until today. It's still holding. This relationship still exists. We've always protected the House of Saud, including when they've done some things that seem pretty bad to us, like when Idi Amin, who was Africa's answer to Hitler, was finally overthrown by a coup. We wanted to try him. We wanted to bring him into our court system or the world court system, but the Saudis offered him sanctuary in Saudi Arabia, where he lived like a king until last summer when he died there of disease. And certainly the Royal House of Saud has supported Osama bin Laden throughout, with our encouragement in Afghanistan when he fought the Russians, but ever since they're still supporting him. The bin Laden family is an extremely important family to the House of Saud, to Saudi Arabia, and to the Carlyle Group, which is, you know, as most people not aware of that group. And so this deal then was a very, very effective one that guaranteed the price of oil stay within acceptable limits and that Saudi Arabia would be rebuilt as a westernized country and we would defend the Saudi, the House of Saud. It's held up. It still holds up. There's a weakness today because many of the conservative Saudis have objected violently to what's going on, and there have been over 100 assassinations in the last year in Saudi Arabia. There's tremendous unemployment. There's a great deal of civil unrest in that country. I think the country's teetering on the verge of some sort of a social upheaval, a political upheaval. We may have to send troops there next. I also know that that's one of the reasons that we went into Iraq, because we feel that in order to protect our oil interests, we've got to control Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and we'd like to control Iran, too.
Now, for you, Saudi Arabia was somewhat different, and maybe not for you, but for the U.S. arrangement with them was different, where they actually had the funds from their oil sales to be able to pay for everything. So how did you approach that that in mind?
Yes, that's right. It wasn't about making them a loan that would make them indebted to us. It was about working a deal that would make them tied to us. So when they send their petrodollars back here and put it in government securities, that gives us quite a lot of control over them. Plus, they signed this agreement whereby the interest would be used by our Treasury Department. An interesting aside to that is that all this money that the Treasury spends and gives to U.S. corporations never has to be approved by the U.S. Congress, because it isn't U.S. taxpayer money, it's Saudi money, even though it comes through the Treasury Department. Once we worked out this deal with Saudi Arabia, a person at a very high level went over and presented it to the royal family. I believe it was Henry Kissinger. And the heads of the royal family accepted it, but the caveat was that it had to get the approval of a number of crown princes. And I was assigned to one of these crown princes to make sure that he approved of this plan. And this was a very interesting process, because he was a strong Wahhabi, very conservative Islamic Arab, and he really didn't want his country to be westernized, so he rejected the plan from the very beginning. But he also let me know if I even wanted him to consider thinking about it, he would expect every time he came to the United States to have a beautiful blue-eyed blonde woman at his disposal. He wanted me to provide that for him. Put me in an awkward position, put me in the position of being a pimp and of actually doing something that was illegal. But I worked this out because I found this woman who was married to a United Airlines pilot. She met all the qualifications. She was beautiful, blonde, blue-eyed, and she was not very happy with her husband. She was happy with her lifestyle and everything her husband provided her, but he was fooling around with a lot of other women, and she knew this, and she was kind of angry about that. In addition, she had been a very promiscuous hippie a few years earlier. So sex was something she enjoyed, and getting a little extra money on the side and sort of socking it to her husband appealed to her. But she let me know that she'd only do it under the condition that she liked the prince. And the first time they got together, fortunately, they liked each other. And I had to pay for it. And this is one of these instances where you can't put it on your expense account. It's illegal. It's an illegal activity. But in those days, restaurants gave you receipts that were hand-printed. They weren't using computers. And I was a big tipper at some very, very fine restaurants in Washington, New York, and Boston. And so when I tipped the waiters, I would always ask for an extra receipt. And I basically financed this this pimping operation that I was going through off receipts from restaurants, and put those on my expense account. There was a lot of that kind of thing going on, too. And eventually, the prince came around and supported our plan, and it went forward in Saudi Arabia. And has been in place ever since. Very effective.
There's been a lot of information coming out very recently about the Bush family ties to Saudi Arabia, doing business there. Were you aware of any of that back when you were working in that area?
Absolutely. And I do want to make it very clear here that empire building, the job of economic hitman, is not partisan. It goes across all administrations. It's the Republicans and the Democrats. The Bush family, of course, is very closely tied to oil, always have been. And I ran an energy company, also a successful one in the 80s, and I was very aware of what was going on with companies like Enron and George Bush, the current president's company. He had a couple of companies. The first one was named Arbusto, which means bush in Spanish. And then he nearly went bankrupt and sold his interest in that to another company called Spectrum 7. And they nearly went bankrupt and sold their interest to Harkin Energy. It was interesting always from my perspective, because Bush kept failing and kept selling his companies. And every time he sold them, he'd get put on the board of the new company and paid huge salaries. And it's like, gee, I wish I could do that. It must be pretty amazing to be in a position where you don't do anything right, but then you get paid for it. Fascinating to watch Harkin Energy, which he then was on the board of and very instrumental. A major oil company was negotiating a contract with Bahrain, a Mideast country, and Harkin then got into the picture. And when the first President Bush became president, suddenly Harkin emerged as the shining light, and the Bahraini government stopped talking to the oil company they had been talking to and brought in Harkin. And they signed an exclusive deal with Harkin, which was the first time an Arab country had signed an exclusive agreement with any oil company. This was unheard of. And the fact they signed it was with Harkin was amazing because a lot of it was offshore drilling. Harkin had never done any offshore drilling. In fact, Harkin had never operated anywhere outside of the Texas-Oklahoma circle, and suddenly found themselves with this very lucrative and lush contract exclusive in Bahrain. And we all knew it was because the, you know, a principal in the Harkin company was the son of the president of the United States. I had an attorney at the time in my own energy company who was a very strong Republican supporter, contributed a lot of money to the Republican Party. I remember him saying to me, "My gosh," he said, I hope that it's worth this president's while, the first Bush, I hope it's worth his while to see his son make a little money, because I sure hope it doesn't destroy the first Bush, the president's reputation, and make him lose the presidency just because he's trying to help his son do well in business. A little ironic when you look back at it now, and of course the first Bush didn't get reelected, the second one has. So those were very interesting times, very interesting.
What about the Bin Laden family? Was that something that you had an awareness of back then?
Oh, yes. The Bin Laden family were very tied in with the Saudi construction industry. They owned the largest construction company, or one of the largest construction companies, in Saudi and in the Middle East. And a lot of the work that was won, a lot of the contracts that were won by our big construction companies, like the Bechtels and Halliburtons and so on and so forth, was subcontracted out to the Bin Laden people. So there was a very, very close connection there, extremely close connection between the oil companies, U.S. construction and engineering companies, and the Bin Laden group.
Do you know through your work as well if Osama Bin Laden's work in Afghanistan when they were fighting the Soviets, was that a well-known fact at the time, or did that emerge later?
Osama bin Laden's war against the Russians?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was very well known. Yeah, in those circles, and yes. We definitely wanted to keep the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan. That's a major corridor for oil from the Caspian Sea area. And, you know, one of the reasons that we're in Iraq today is because in the late 90s, in fact, under the Clinton administration, it became quite apparent that we didn't have the kinds of reserves of oil around the world, particularly in the Caspian area, that everybody thought we had. It became quite apparent that the oil companies were inflating their estimates of reserves in order to inflate their stock prices. Now, Enron was found out doing this, and WorldCom and several others, but the fact of the matter is most all the oil companies were doing it. And so once the powers that be, once the government became aware that this was happening, there was a huge concern that we're going to run out of oil. And, you know, we're in the process right now, this global empire, of running out of everything, including markets, because every other empire in history has had geographic areas to move on to. There have been new frontiers. Ours doesn't. We encompass the globe. We encompass all the populations of the globe. So once you've encompassed that, how do you keep growing those markets, especially if the poor are getting poorer, and they're one of the big markets? So there was this big concern in the late 90s as to what's going to happen to our economy. And a lot of it hinged on oil and the fact that the oil reserve estimates were all inflated. And so we realized back then, and again, this is under Clinton, that we needed to take control of Iraqi oil fields. We were also concerned that the Saudis were going to go under, that there was going to be a revolution in that country. We needed to strengthen our position in Saudi, Kuwait, and Iraq, and hopefully, under the scenario, in Iran also. At the same time, Nigeria is resisting us, one of the other big producers. Venezuela, which has fluctuated between being our third and fourth largest supplier, was saying no. They elected Hugo Chavez as president. He's very anti-American. And he's saying, I'm not going to give you guys any more oil. And at the same time, all during the 80s, the economic hitmen had been in Iraq trying to convince Saddam Hussein to do the same thing that the Royal House of Saud had done in Saudi Arabia. We tried desperately to get Saddam Hussein to buy that same scenario that had been so successful in Saudi Arabia. He didn't buy. He wouldn't buy into it at all. And so in the 80s, we sent in the jackals to overthrow his government, That didn't work. We sent in the Jackals to assassinate him. They couldn't get through to him because his Republican Guard, his security forces, were just too loyal, too strong. And besides, there were like 12 or 15 Saddams. You know, he had all these doubles. We couldn't assassinate him. So he provided a very convenient excuse, and I think we nudged him into it. He attacked Kuwait. And we were sworn to defend Kuwait. And had he gone into Kuwait, the next would have been Saudi Arabia. So it gave us the perfect excuse to go after him. The economic hitmen had failed. The Jackals had failed. The next step is to send in the military. We thought we needed an excuse. He gave us the perfect excuse when he went into Kuwait. We went in. We attacked him. We essentially destroyed his army, but we didn't get him. However, we thought he had been sufficiently chastised that now the economic hitmen could win him over. So during the 90s, the economic hitmen went back in. Now, had Saddam bought the way Saudi did, we would have given him or sold him all the fighter planes he wanted, the missiles. We would have built him chemical plants and biological plants and nuclear power plants, probably. We've done that plenty of other places. But he didn't buy, and he would still be president if he had just gone along with our system. But he took sort of the same sort of kind of a stance that an Omar Torrijos took. It was very independent, I think, for very different reasons. I think Saddam Hussein was probably just plain crazy. I mean, I don't know why he didn't buy. I know why Torrijos didn't. It was very principled. I don't think Saddam had those principles at all. Nonetheless, he didn't buy. The assassins tried to get him again in the 90s without any success. And so, once again, we sent in our young men and women to die and to be killed. And it's interesting to me that during the first Gulf War, at that time we were importing about 8 million barrels of oil a day. At the time of the second Gulf War, we were importing about 12 million barrels of oil a day. We'd increased our dependence on foreign oil by 50% during that time period, which is a little shocking and discouraging.
I think it's interesting that you were originally approached for going into Saudi Arabia by the Treasury Department, because I know that during the 80s, the transfers of military hardware that we did give to Iraq, and including what biological stuff they did have, went through the Treasury Department funded all that. It's my understanding.
I don't know about that specifically, because I was very seldom involved in weapons dealing, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit. I mean, these departments work very closely together. And it's always the objective to keep as much off the military budget as you possibly can, because everybody knows that, you know, people object to military budgets. You want to keep those low.
One of the things you point out in your book is, in addition to Iraq being on top of so much oil, is they also have a significant control over water in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Both the Tigris and Euphrates River flow out of Iraq. Iraq is a very strategic country. That water that flows out of there goes to the other parts of the Middle East, but Iraq controls it. Iraq could conceivably shut down that water by damming up those rivers if it really wanted to. And, of course, if you look at a map and you look at what borders Iraq, it's everybody, you know, including Iran, including most of the Arab countries. And Iraq is within easy missile distance of Russia and Israel. Iraq could send missiles very easily into all of those countries. And it's very, very strategic. It's been, in the days of the American Revolution, it was considered that anybody who controlled the Hudson River Valley would control the continent. And I've seen modern historians write the same thing about Iraq. If you can control Iraq, you can control the Middle East. Frankly, I'm not sure that either of those were true. The British did control the Hudson River Valley for a long time, and they lost the revolution. And I don't know that Iraq is really that strategic from that standpoint, but it certainly does have the resources, the water, and the oil.
All right, let's talk about some of the other countries that you worked with in South America. Another person that you had a friendship with was the leader of Ecuador, is that right?
Right, Jaime Roldos. First democratically elected president of Ecuador in many, many years. The country had been run essentially by military and other dictatorships. And Jaime Roldos came in on a populist platform. One of the things that he came in on was that he would oppose the oil companies. He would not let the oil companies rape his land anymore. And he was elected with a very substantial majority. He was a very, very popular man. as soon as he became president, he immediately started implementing what he called the hydrocarbons policy, which in Spanish that essentially translates as oil, and started negotiating with the oil companies, started telling the oil companies that they were going to have to make sure that more of the oil revenue came back to his people. And he threw out a missionary group called the Summer Institute of Linguistics, SIL. Now, this was an evangelical missionary group based out of Oklahoma that had extremely close ties to oil companies that went back into the time when I was a Peace Corps volunteer and even before, in the 60s, even back to the 50s. And these missionaries were financed by oil companies. They had a long history of going in and working with the indigenous people. When the oil companies discovered or thought that there was a good possibility that oil lay under the lands lived on by indigenous people, SIL would go in and convince these people to move off their lands and onto missionary reservations and sign their lands over to the oil company. In turn, the missionaries were financed by the oil companies. So there was this very, very cozy relationship, and SIL used some interesting techniques to get these people off the lands at time, which are described in some detail in the book. There's a number of them. I mean, it's amazing what they did. And just as one example, they would send food into indigenous villages and lace it heavily with laxatives. So the people in the village would get bad dysentery, what they thought was dysentery, and the missionaries then would come in with medicines that would very quickly cure it. Of course, they knew what caused it. It was their own laxatives. And say that God had sent them and that they were there to help the people, et cetera, et cetera. And some much more incredible things described in the books. For example, how they had an ears and eyes operation where they could actually listen to everything that was spoken in the indigenous homes and respond that way and say that God had sent them. Fascinating what they went through. Very well documented, not only in my book, but in other sources. And so one of the first things Jaime Roldos did after being elected was go after SIL and said, these people are not what they say they are. We've got to get them out, and we're going to take care of the oil companies. It was, in fact, a day that he gave a very vitriolic speech against the SIL. It threw SIL out of the country that day, announced they were going to throw them out, and gave this speech against the oil companies. And either that day or a day or two later, his helicopter exploded in midair. There was, again, no question that it was an assassination, at least not in my mind and not in the mind of many, many people. And I'd seen it coming. We economic hitmen were not getting through to Jaime Roldos. He was determined to go after the oil companies. He was determined to get for his country what he thought was the right thing. And we couldn't change him. And the inevitable happened. He was taken up by the jackals.
And again, one of the big threats, in addition to not giving us the access to all their resources, was that he would potentially become an example to the rest of the world.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the world was watching. Jaime wanted to renegotiate all the contracts with the oil companies, make sure that they gave a lot more back to the Ecuadorian people, and they could not afford to see this happen in Ecuador, because if it happened in Ecuador, everybody else around the world would know about it, and it would happen in those places too. Obviously, Peru and Colombia are neighbors to Ecuador. They would be immediately impacted. But the news would get out through OPEC and throughout the world that Jaime had stood up the oil companies and had won. The oil companies could not let that happen.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with John Perkins. He is author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. You mentioned Colombia. Did you have any experience with Colombia, since we're sending so much military aid down there?
I had a lot of experience with Colombia. I spent probably a year or more living in Colombia, but over a period of maybe 5 or 6 years, I'd go there for 2 or 3 months and was very close to them. I had an office in Colombia for a short period of time. I also was in the process of buying a small coffee farm in Colombia. I loved Colombia, and I had very good friends there. And yes, Colombia is a fascinating example, because the movements that we talk about today as being driven by narcotics and terrorism started as very grassroots movements opposed to the things that we were doing. My own company was designing and managing the construction of a large hydroelectric system in Colombia, and the local people strongly opposed this project, because they knew that it was damming up their rivers, it was changing everything in their environment, changing all the water resources. And they knew that the big transmission lines were going to go over their lands. They were not going to get any electricity themselves. It was all going up to the big cities, to the industries and the industrialists, to the wealthy people. They were incensed, and so they opposed us. And a guerrilla movement started up and would go into our camp, our construction camp, and take hostages, even to the point where our State Department demanded that, our embassy in Colombia insisted that we not ever send any American engineers, North American engineers, U.S. citizens, into our own construction site. We could only send Colombians in. We had to hire Colombian engineers, and there were a lot of very good ones, to do this. So the guerrillas would come into our construction camp and cause a lot of disruption and take hostages and so forth. And they were really, had a very legitimate gripe, you know. They were being screwed. Colombia was taking huge loans from the big international banks in order to build these facilities, to hire U.S. companies to build these facilities that were providing electricity to a few of the very wealthy families. And the peasants, the campesinos, the poor people of Colombia were going to be stuck with the loans ultimately, so it would affect their health care, their education, everything else. And they weren't getting any benefits. In fact, these projects were hurting their lands, causing tremendous disruption to them. And out of that grew this movement that had to turn someplace for training and weapons. If you're going to take on the big international oil companies and the mercenaries that they bring in, and ultimately perhaps the U.S. government, at least a lot of stuff that's funded by them, and the Colombian army and police force that's funded by the U.S. government, if you're going to do that, then you've got to get weapons and training someplace. Now, in those days, the Colombians, FARC, and there were a number of groups that grew out of this, turned to either Russia or China or Cuba. And that we thought that was pretty bad. We accused them of being communists and socialists. And in many cases, they really weren't. They just needed to get training and weapons, and that's where they got them from. But that was sort of a moderating influence on our government. As long as Russia and China and Cuba were major forces, when we saw these sorts of things happening, we would also often modify our relations with countries and tone down a little bit. But as time went on, and Russia and China fell by the way, and now basically, there is no worldwide communist movement. We're it. We're unopposed as a world power. The United States is unopposed today as the world empire. This has put these organizations, these grassroots people who want to resist us, in a very, very awkward position. In the case of Colombia, they've gone into drug dealing, and they'd started this a little bit before, but they've gone into drug manufacturing and dealing. They've gone into kidnapping. They've gone into extortion, in order to finance their need for weapons and training. In the process, they've become very corrupted, too. A number of these organizations, too, today have simply become about drugs. They have become narco-trafficking groups and the drug wars we're all familiar with. But what really started off as a grassroots resistance to U.S. policy of making these loans and building these projects has now mushroomed into this nightmarish situation, which is totally out of control and is no longer ideologically based. Some of it still may be, but for the most part, it's just become a huge, you know, gang war. But it started because these people opposed us. I find this, Mike, terrifying in the overall scheme of things. Today, more than ever, because right now, I know that my friends in the Amazon, the Shwa, the Achwa, the Warani, the tribes that live in the Amazon who are opposing our oil companies and have said they will fight to the last man, they are right now being accused of being part of Al-Qaeda. Some of the nonprofit, I'm on the boards directors of several nonprofits that work in those areas. One of our nonprofits has been accused of being an Al-Qaeda operation. It absolutely is not. It's run by quite conservative people out of San Francisco. It's raised millions of dollars to help the people in the Amazon. We have nothing to do with terrorism. But this accusation is now out there because we're working with people who are actively opposing oil on their lands and are being called part of Al-Qaeda. The Shwa, the Achwa, these indigenous people, are philosophically at the other end of the spectrum from groups like Al-Qaeda. They have no interest in what they're doing ideologically. The problem is that if they end up fighting the oil companies and the mercenaries that are attached to those companies, They can't do this with blowguns and machetes. They're going to need real weapons. And the only place today that these kinds of people can go for real weapons and weapons training are the terrorist organizations. So ultimately, people who oppose us for the best of reasons and often very legitimately end up having to join the terrorist movement, the worldwide terrorist movement, because they have no other options. And I think that's scary. I think people should have a right to defend their lands and some place to turn to get support. But we've seen to it that they don't have any place to turn. We ourselves in this country did the same thing when we opposed England. When the Minutemen opposed the British Empire, we turned to the French, we turned to the Hessians, we turned to many other places to help provide us with arms and moral support, financial support, and military support. People always need, coming from the grassroots, need help. They need support. And today, there's none out there for these kinds of people except the terrorist organizations.
And it's my understanding the British back during that time called us terrorists because we did horrible things like individually would hide behind trees while we shot our muskets.
Well, we were terrorists. You know, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Tom Paine and all the patriots, when all those men signed the Declaration of Independence, they stuck their head in a noose. They were traitors to their government, which was the British Crown. They were absolutely traitors, and they would have been hanged had they lost the Revolution. I mean, these were men of tremendous courage. Some of them had a lot of money, like George Washington, one of the wealthiest men in the colonies at the time, and John Hancock. They put everything at risk. And yeah, then they implemented terrorist maneuvers in fighting the British. They had to. They fought from behind stone walls and trees. The Minutemen were, you know, the equivalent of the modern-day terrorist organization. But we were doing it for a just cause, right? And, you know, the truth is, so are a lot of these other people. If we understood what they're fighting against us, that's a tough one. But I think we've reached a point in time where we all need to exercise the kind of courage that George Washington and those other patriots exercised. We need to be willing to put our heads in a noose to make this a better world. We have the opportunity now to create a better world. This very empire that we've built, these institutions that we have, like the World Bank and many of our corporations, could be used, instead of just sucking resources from other parts of the world, they could be used to send out resources, to send out compassion, and to send out food to starving people, and water to people who are dying of thirst, and medicines to people, to children who are dying of curable diseases. We could make that happen. It's all in place. We have the resources, we have the wealth, we have the networks to make this happen. We are at a time in history where I think there's tremendous hope of really bringing the dream of those founding fathers of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to the entire world. You know, here we are in the state of Washington. I grew up in one of the 13 colonies, New Hampshire, but I was never raised to believe that the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was intended for those 13 colonies. I was always raised to believe that it included Washington State also, and California, and Texas even. And I was never raised to believe that it needed to stop at the Rio Grande or the Canadian border. I was raised to believe that that was a vision for the whole world. It grew out of many of the philosophers like John Locke in Europe, and it grew out of a study by people like Washington and Jefferson and Franklin of the indigenous cultures in this land, the democratic approach that the Iroquois and other indigenous people had. So our vision of our Declaration of Independence and the government we set up after that was truly global. The philosophy behind it came from all over the world, including our own North American indigenous people. And it's meant for the world. We have now reached a point in time where we can take this out to the world. I'm not talking about one world government. I don't think that's wise at all. But I am talking about creating a situation where people all over the world feel that they have the security to exercise the kinds of freedoms that we can exercise in this country, where a Filipino or a Nicaraguan doesn't have to come to the United States to feel that they can gain those rights, but can stay in their own country and have those same rights. And that's what we need to be focused on. And I have tremendous hope in that. That's why I wrote the book after 9/11, because I saw that we're just going to continue having more 9/11s unless we do something to change this. And we are at a time of immense opportunity. We Americans can take this empire and put it back into the republic and take that idea of the Republic to the whole world and show great compassion and in the same time guarantee our own security here at home.
Talk about how you finally left Chaz-T Maine, because you've mentioned your company a couple times, and I don't think we've really clarified that you have gone on to other things, much better things, since you left there.
Well, you're right. The guilt got to me, and in the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I spent quite a lot of time talking about how I struggled with this guilt from the very beginning, but I was seduced by sex, money, and power, and continued for a number of years, but finally it just got to be too much for me. And I had an epiphany. I had a moment of great enlightenment while sailing in the Virgin Islands. And I go into detail in the book, so I won't do it here. But to make a long story short, I knew I had to get out. And I knew if I didn't get out then, I would be hooked forever, because I was becoming very wealthy. And it was becoming very, very plush, very cozy, very soft. And I knew that if I didn't get out then, I would never get out. And so I took the leap, and I quit. But I didn't really get out of that point, because I ended up going back and doing consulting work, and I ended up forming an alternative energy company which built environmentally good power plants in this country. And we changed the utility industry in this country by doing that, and we changed some of the laws around it for the positive. But in that process, it was interesting. I kept getting these favors, including the U.S. Congress read into the congressional record an exemption for my company from a certain tax that everybody else had to pay, which enabled us to go forward and do one of these projects. I kept getting these favors that I knew came as a reward for my service as an economic hitman. And I also kept getting this advice, these threats, sort of a combination of threats and bribes, that I mustn't tell my story. And if I didn't tell my story, if I stayed a good boy, I would continue to be rewarded, and I was. So even though I got out of the system and quit the company, quit Charles T. Maine, which shortly after that was sold to another company, no longer became a closely held partnership, but was sold to another company, and eventually the Maine logo and name was retired in the mid-80s. But once I got out, I still continued to be very highly influenced by the profession and the people around it, including in the 1990s, I was ready to write this book. I called it at that time Conscience of an Economic Hitman, but I'd begun it. It's changed since then, but the foundation was there. The word got out that I was writing it, and a major engineering firm brought me on as a consultant with nothing to do. I didn't have to do anything except fly down to Rio de Janeiro and take a few private jets around periodically and go to dinner with the rich and famous of the world. And they paid me $500,000 basically not to write the book. I took the bribe, and I continued to take these bribes, and I continued to take the safe way and feeling guilty about it. Meanwhile, I had a daughter. She's growing up. I'm feeling kind of guilty about it, but I'm assuaging my guilt by doing a lot of nonprofit work with indigenous people all through the 90s. I ran an organization called Dream Change. It was still a great organization. We have a website, dreamchange.org. I was on the board of another nonprofit, Pachamama Alliance. We did a lot of really good things, and it assuaged my guilt a lot. But then September 11th happened, and I was in the Amazon at the time with the indigenous people there when this happened. It was a very powerful experience for me. And then I came home and went to Ground Zero. And while I was at Ground Zero, and it was still smoldering, and you could still smell the charred bodies, it was a very powerful experience. I said to myself, I can no longer put this off. I've got to expose the truth behind this. We can't let this happen again. The world needs to know part of the reason of why this is happening. Part of the reason is because there are men and women out there who are EHMs, economic hitmen, like me. The world needs to know this. The citizens of the United States need to know where their tax dollars are going, where the profits that these big corporations are making off our purchases are going. It needs to be told, because if the American people understand what's going on, they won't put up with it anymore. They'll change it. The systems are all in place for us to change it in a way that will be very positive and make for a much better world. And that's the world I want to see my daughter inherit from me.
And since you've come out with the book, what has been the reaction of those that you formerly worked with?
Well, the book officially just came out a couple of days ago, so it really hasn't been out. But I sent a preview copy to the man who originally hired me, who's now retired, and wrote me a long letter, very interesting, and basically substantiating everything in the book, and saying that it's encouraged him to write a book himself. I'm hoping that some of the other economic hitmen will come out of the closet now and talk about this. Some other interesting things have happened. As I mentioned earlier, just this morning, or yesterday actually, the book went to number one on Amazon.com. I think since then it's dropped back to like four or something, but it's amazing how it's selling. It's incredible, and I've been getting some great reaction from the media. But the other side of it is a lot of resistance. I was scheduled to be on a major network show two nights ago, a major network show broadcast all over, a conservative show, and I was surprised that they asked me on, but I really welcomed the opportunity to speak out to those people, you know, because they're the ones who really need to hear this, and I was one of them once. 2 hours before I was supposed to go on the air, they called and canceled for political purposes, for political reasons. I mean, they said that right outright, that we really don't think this is the right time to have you on the show. And that was a little shocking to me and disappointing. I mean, they kept me hanging in there. This was in New York, and, you know, I'd flown up to New York to be on the show. As it turned out, I was on other shows too, so it was okay. But it told me so much about the system, and I find that very disturbing that people like that are not willing to hear the other side. I was fully expecting to be attacked by them, which is fine. I think to have a discourse, even if somebody's attacking you and you have to defend yourself, that's good. I welcome the opportunity for people to call me whatever they want, a liar, say that what I'm writing about is not true. I welcome that opportunity because I can substantiate everything that I say in the book as far as what's happened in the world. Every event I describe in that book, every assassination, every deal that we did with every country that we did it, is on the record. My own personal story is my personal story, but the deals that came out of that, everything that happened, is totally on the record.
And now we are at the point in historical terms of a lot of people say that the empire that we have can't keep going in the direction it's been going, that as you pointed out, we've fully encircled the globe, and the opening up markets is, you know, limited at this point. And you point out that there's every reason to believe that we could do a shift towards taking the structures that we have and putting them to good use. Do you think that people in this country, people of the empire, are willing and ready for that?
Yes, I think they are if they understand. I think the biggest problem in the empire in this country is that people don't understand. Most of us don't understand what pawns we are to this system, and how only a very few people at the very top are gaining from it. I'm not even sure they're gaining. You know, here we have the wealthiest country in the history of the world. And if you look at our social statistics, we're probably one of the least happy. If you look at things like suicide rate and drug rate and incarceration and family abuse and family violence, our statistics are terrible. They tell us that all this material wealth has not brought us happiness. And that's not just true amongst the poor people in our country. It's also true amongst some of the very wealthiest. The rates of divorce, the rates of suicide, the rates of drug abuse are outrageous. So here we've created this empire. It's the wealthiest. It's the first truly global empire. It's not a happy empire. And we've learned from history that empires never last. They always fall. They destroy a lot of people, a lot of cultures, and then they destroy themselves. And of course we're going to go that same route. You can't sustain yourself if you're non-sustainable. And this empire is non-sustainable, ultimately. So it will fall. But rather than allow that to happen in a violent sort of a way, in a traumatic sort of way, the other alternative is that we could create something entirely new in history. We could turn this empire into a compassionate republic that takes itself out to the world, embraces the world, unifies the world, brings people together, teaches a lesson of love and compassion. We're in an incredible position to do that, so let's do it. And the only way that's going to happen is if we all become fully conscious of what it is we're doing. Probably shouldn't say fully conscious. If we all become more conscious of what it is we're doing, and what the footprint we're leaving on this Earth is doing for our children and our grandchildren, and set as our new goal, our new dream, if you will, one that really honors life throughout the planet and that rejects this sense that materialism is going to bring us happiness, because we've proven that it isn't. We need the basics. We all need food, clothing, shelter, and good environments to live in, and the opportunity to love our kids and teach them the things that they need to learn. Everybody all over this planet wants this. A few of us have it, but an awful lot don't, and some people have way in excess of anything like that. They've gone way beyond it. If we could take that concept to everybody on this planet and feel it in our hearts, ooh, what a great opportunity. And you know what? The indigenous cultures around the world, and every culture around the world that I know of, has prophesied this time as a time when that opportunity exists. I mean, it's the new age. It's the new millennium. It's the Christian millennium. The Hebrew culture has a prophecy of this type in it. The Hopi, the Maya, the Quechua, the Shwa, the Achwa, the Tibetans, the Buddhists, the Bans, the Zulus, the Bushmen, the Australian Aborigines, and the Navajo, the Lakota. You can just go through and name it, and every one of them comes back to right now as being a time in history when the opportunity exists to, as the Quechua people in the Andes call it, the Pachacuti, a time to set things right. And we have entered this period by all these prophecies. We are in it right now. And that's not a coincidence.
Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
My pleasure, Mike. Thank you. Thank you for all the good work you're doing.
We've just been talking with John Perkins. He is author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman.